This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
They used to be regular guests in our homes anytime we chose, entertaining us when we switched on our radio and television sets. Now it's time to hear again the voices that came out of the glow. How's it been over the last 2 weeks? Steve and myself, Paul F., hope it has gone absolutely splendidly for you. On the program this afternoon, it's Time to Remember, as always, an extract from a program from the BBC series of that name with Leslie Bailey. Jim Reeves is here again on the Grand Ole Opry. Nina and Frederick are giving a concert in the Groove, and a couple who were to the manor born. We begin with an extract from Programme 8 from the series Time to Remember. It's called History is People, which it is, isn't it?
Time to Remember. Program presented by the BBC, in which Leslie Bailey, journalist and broadcaster, looks back on some of the events of our lives. In today's program, Leslie Bailey brings us into direct touch with some of the greatest discoveries of modern times. First, we go over to one of London's hospitals.
I'm speaking to you from the Wright Fleming Institute of Microbiology. It's part of St. Mary's, this great hospital close by Paddington Station in London. One little room in this hospital is unique because it's the scene of quite one of the most important discoveries in mankind's long battle against disease and suffering. In this room, in 1928, the late Sir Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin. He was a bacteriologist, and in the laboratory where I am now, Sir Alexander worked to the last day of his life. And working here now is Lady Fleming.
In September 1928, Professor Fleming, as he was known then, was working in a little laboratory here. He was studying the staphylococci, which are microbes which cause certain diseases. To study them, he had put some of the microbes on a glass dish containing a jelly, which is the food for the microbes. It is made from meat. It's a sort of broth, and there they grow and make children, and they form large families, what we call colonies. You might perhaps like to see the original glass dish he used with the microbes on which the discovery started.
Yes, indeed, this is fascinating. The actual dish, it's a small saucer, and across one side of it are scattered a large number of yellow blobs. Now, what are those, Lady Fleming?
They are the colonies of staphylococci, very, very many microbes all together.
What would they cause if they were to get onto me?
If you had no resistance, they might cause boils or might cause blood poisoning.
That was the beginning of an interview I had not long ago with Lady Fleming, a Greek research worker who worked in Alexander Fleming's laboratory and married him a few years before his death. This journey of mine to St. Mary's Hospital was an experience to remember. To hold in one's hand that simple little glass saucer, the origin of an epoch-making discovery. All his life, Alexander Fleming had been interested in ways of fighting the bacterial infections. During the 1914-18 war, he studied the very unsatisfactory action of the then so-called antiseptics on infected wounds. He had little success. Most people would have been disheartened. But all those years of research had one supreme value. They alerted Fleming's mind, prepared it for any possible clue. And one day, the clue came. Fleming was a rugged, homely Scot, and luckily for us all, very untidy. he left dishes like this one lying about in his laboratory. One day, he happened to look at this old dish again. His sharp eye spotted some green mold on it. You can still see it on the dish, which is kept as a museum piece at the hospital today.
Yes, it is the sort of thing you see on cheese or marmalade or bread. These molds come by accident. The original microscopical beginning of it is a spore, a minute particle floating in the air. It must have been floating about in the lab and came down and settled on the dish.
But wasn't this mold rather spoiling his research? Why didn't he now throw the plate away?
He had the real naturalist capacity for observation, and he noticed that something very astonishing had occurred. Do you see what has happened here on the plate?
It is astonishing. All around this patch of green mold, the yellow blobs, the colonies of microbes, have disappeared. Up to a distance of an inch from the mold, they are still positively yellow. Closer than that, they become almost like raindrops, transparent. Does that mean they're harmless?
Yes. He recognized at once that this mold must have been producing a substance which was dissolving the microbes. He set to work to study the substance, which he called penicillin, as thoroughly as he could. He examined it to see whether it would injure the human cells, and when he found that it did not, while it destroyed many of the microbes which caused diseases, he predicted that, purified, it could be used to kill the microbes of many human infections.
So this little dish belongs to a discovery, perhaps the greatest discovery ever made in curative medicine.
Yes, that's quite true. Professor Fleming found that penicillin acted selectively against a very large number of very harmful bacteria, which cause many serious diseases.
In 1928, this discovery went almost unnoticed. Fleming wrote a paper about it in the medical press, but 13 years were to pass before a method of mass producing penicillin in the factory was developed by two research workers at Oxford University, Sir Howard Florey and Dr. Chain. And now, here is the recorded voice of the late Sir Alexander Fleming himself.
The crude penicillin I made in those days was weak and much too impure for injection into the body. It was in 1941 that the true value of penicillin in the treatment of human infections was appreciated. That was in the midst of war, and when it was found that it had a wonderful effect on septic wounds, there was a great drive to have it produced on both sides of the Atlantic. All the early work on penicillin was done in England, and all the information as to how to produce it was given freely to the United States.
Alexander Fleming's work received little recognition in his lifetime and hasn't had much since. But it's a splendid example of the prepared mind, readied through years of quiet work for that flash of exceptional insight, which is genius. Now let's move back in time to 1903. This was the year when the Wright brothers flew the first aeroplane in America. It was also the year of another discovery of consequence both in peace and war, made by two poverty-stricken French scientists, Pierre and Marie Curie. A London journalist who called at their laboratory in Paris was shown a white powder in a tube, but warned not to go near it. He wrote afterwards in the Strand magazine of January 1904,
"This strange substance gives forth not only light and heat, but invisible rays. These rays may be helpful or harmful. They may destroy life or stimulate it."
The substance was radium. The journalist of 1904 added,
"Already a London doctor has reported a case of cancer cured by radium."
Today, in the 1960s, millions of pounds worth of radium is used for healing the sick. That's how Madame Curie meant it to be used. And this was what her daughter, the authoress, Eve Curie, asked me to stress to the radio-listening public when I went over to Paris to see her soon after she'd published her best-selling biography of her mother. As I stood at the door of Eve Curie's flat and rang the bell, I wondered what sort of a person this daughter of two great scientists would be. I'd heard about her formidable elder sister, Professor Irène Joliot-Curie, the atomic scientist, who so disliked the idea of an American film about their mother that when she found a Hollywood camera crew installed in the Curie laboratory in Paris, she sent them packing. The scientist sister was no lover of publicity. How would the writer sister respond to my request for her help in a broadcast? Well, the Eve Curie who asked me in is a typical Parisienne. Elegant, fashionable, intelligent, sensitive, humorous. She told me she personally hadn't objected so much to the Hollywood film because she hoped it might bring her parents' work and intentions before the world. This, too, was her attitude towards my suggested broadcast. She told me a great deal about her parents.
A little from Time to Remember. Joining us now is Jim Reeves, again from the Grand Ole Opry program. He sings for us According to My Heart and the very popular Mexican Joe. Afternoon to you, Ted Moore in Rangiora, and to the McNaughtons, Grace and Brian of Brightstone Crescent, and also to Blair Smith in Brindwa.
According to my heart, according to my heart, the future will be bright. And every day I pray that my heart knows what's right.
Hey, I know a lad, he's got more fun than anybody's had. Don't got no worry, don't got no dough. Everybody's wondering about Mexican Joe. In old Mexico, they call him the Rumba King. Leads all the women around on a string. When they go out, they get a million thrills. But the lovely senoritas wind up with the bills. Dancing, romancing, always on the go. Sun shining down on Mexican Joe. He makes the night spots all along the bay. People want to see him when he comes their way. He spreads so much joy everywhere he goes. Everyone shouts, Viva la Mexican Joe. He likes to gamble at poker, he's an ace. He's always lucky with the cards that got a face. At winning the money, he is sure a whiz. But when they win, they don't collect cause they don't know where he is. Dancing, romancing, always on the go. Sun shining down on Mexican Joe.
got no income tax, cause he don't got no dough. Still he gets along just fine, how we'll never know. He's got everything he wants, a girl, a drink, a song. If we use his formula, we surely can't go wrong. His favorite playground is anywhere there's girls. He's got that something that sets their heart awhirl. It couldn't be his money, cause he ain't gotta pay so. But when he wants a kiss, all he gotta do is say so. Dancing, romancing, always on the go. Sun shining down on Mexican Joe.
Mexican Joe, and According to My Heart, Jim Reeves on the Grand Ole Opry. This is Out of the Glow, a program of broadcasting nostalgia on Plains FM, Christchurch. Parade tells the story this time of Roman Empress Theodora, played here by Lyndall Barber from Portia Faces Life.
Parade! A cavalcade of people, places, and memorable events. Fourteen 1400 years ago, lived and died a woman whom history knows as the Empress Theodora. A woman who rose from the gutter to become the despotic ruler of the vast and sprawling Roman Empire. She began her career as an actress, but gave up her career to join Hecabalus, a young civil servant in North Africa.
The wind hasn't dropped. The air is full of locusts.
Oh, my love, it will pass. It will be difficult for a time, but soon the land will flourish again.
When, Theodora? Can you answer me that?
I don't know. Perhaps a year, perhaps longer.
Libya. It could be the pit of hell itself. Ever since I came here, I've felt as though I'd been cursed.
We still have each other.
Have we?
You know I'll never leave you.
Perhaps that is my curse.
You no longer love me, do you?
No.
And yet I've been faithful to you. I've given you my heart.
The day I met you, I was cursed.
I shall leave your house today. Be happy in the knowledge that I shall no longer be with you.
In Byzantium, the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire, Theodora abandoned herself to a life of pleasure. She became notorious, her very name became a byword for scandal. One day she went to the great cathedral in Byzantium to pray, and a group of citizens forbade her to enter.
Theodora, you are a creature of sin.
It's because I have sinned that I am repentant.
Do not soil this sacred place with your vile presence.
All I want to do is pray before the altar. I've come here veiled and without jewels. I beg you, let me enter.
Oh, it would be blasphemy.
Please, I beg you.
Who dares to quarrel in the house of the Lord?
My Lord Justinian, it is the actress Theodora. She wants to enter the church.
The church is for all men and for all women.
But this woman is the scandal of the city.
Do you repent of your sins, Theodora?
I do, my Lord.
Then take my hand. You shall enter the church with me.
Justinian was the emperor's nephew, and he fell deeply in love with Theodora. 2 years later, the crown was his, and Justinian begged Theodora to be his wife and empress.
Many men have offered me their love. No man has ever asked me to marry him. And yet now you want to make me empress of the Roman Empire.
Theodora soon assumed a dominating power over her adoring husband and became the virtual ruler of the Roman world. She ruled as a despot, but she eventually outlived her scandalous reputation in the city of Byzantium. In her later years, Theodora became famous for her piety and good works. You have been listening to the dramatization of a true story from the pages of the national monthly magazine, Parade.
Out of the Glow is about melodies and moments from broadcasting history. This is Paul Featherston, inviting you to tune to an hour of comedy, featured artists, personalities, and sports coverage on Plains FM 96.9, the first two Sundays of the month at 5 p.m.
There's the dropout by Oxley. It won't go over the 25. He's trying to kick it along the line.
We drop in now on Penelope Keith and Peter Bowles in scenes from To the Manor Born, an episode to do with a nation's heritage. Greetings to Kathleen and Doug Corbett in Glenora Place, Hornby, and to Jim Smart in Papanui. Afternoon to you.
Morning, Mrs. Patterson. Is my shopping ready?
Yes, it is. Oh, except for the Royal Games suit. We haven't got any of that, dear.
Why not?
Well, there's no call for it.
Of course there is. I called for it.
It's a nice man up the manor now, Mr. De Vere. Gets his cigars here, you know, specially ordered, just come in.
I thought you said you couldn't cater for singular tastes.
Well, I have to think of my profit, dear. I mean, there's a difference between one tin of game soup and a box of Havanas. Now, that's £2.40 for the papers.
As much as that?
Well, you haven't paid for 3 weeks. £3. £2.40, that's...
60 pence change.
No, dear, I forgot to add the delivery charge, so that's exactly right. Very nice man, Mr. De Vere. They say he's knocking ale out of the manor.
Is he indeed? How much is this bread and ham?
Oh, not for sale, dear. I'm keeping that back, Mrs. Cartwright.
Linda's mother?
Young Linda's calling for it later on.
But Linda is my domestic.
Oh, we're all supposed to be equal now, dear, aren't we?
Oh, hello. Fancy seeing you in here. Oh,
good morning, Mr. De Vere.
Good morning.
Mr. De Vere, your cigars have arrived, sir. And your horse and hound.
Oh, thank you.
Horse and hound? I'd no idea you hunted.
Oh, yes. Hunting, shooting, fishing, what? It's expected of the squire, don't you know? Well, I better pay you, Mrs. Patterson.
Oh, any time, sir. No hurry.
Oh. Whatever's happening at the manor. So it's true. The wretched man is knocking hell out of the place.
Perhaps he's seeing to the dry rot and the rising damp and the death potch beetle.
No, Marjorie, he is functionalising. I don't know what that means, but it's bound to be something flashy and vulgar.
Well, if it deals with the dry rot and the rising damp and the death watch beetle.
I hope you're not standing up for him.
Yes, I am. I don't think he's half as bad as you make out.
No? Then answer me this. I don't mind having to move here. I can learn to live in this shoebox. I can put up with having to turn a corner every 2 feet and treading in Bertie's bowl every 5 minutes. But I resent De Vere running off with my domestics and telling me to become a typist and getting credit from Mrs. Patterson when I have to pay cash and put up with her calling me dear and telling me that we're all equal nowadays. On top of that, she gives De Vere a breaded ham that I wanted to buy, which she was saving for Linda Cartwright's mother. I mean, the whole fabric of society is becoming irreparably unstitched. Well?
What was the question again?
I've forgotten, but you know how I feel. After all, I want to get on with him, but how can I when he patronises me all the time?
Oh, I'm sure he doesn't mean toward. Isn't this you at badminton?
Yes, it is.
I didn't know you had this.
Oh, Ravenger found it when we were unpacking.
But isn't that the Queen you're talking to?
Oh, yes, so it is. I remember she was there.
To put it up?
I don't want to be ostentatious. Anyway, I can't find anywhere suitable.
Well, what about the mantelpiece?
You won't get it on that hideous little thing. That was designed for people who expected nothing better than a get-well card. Now what's he up to?
I don't believe it.
What's happened now?
De Vere is throwing out that lovely old fireplace from Martel's study.
Oh, Aud, what a whopper. You've always hated that fireplace.
Oh, this is too much. He has to be stopped.
You know perfectly well it was put there in the war to cover up the big hearth during the fuel shortage.
That's not the point, Marjorie.
And only the other week you said how ugly it was.
Well, of course I know that, but does he? I doubt if he could tell a good fireplace from Adam.
I'm going to know it. Oh, golly, Aud.
Well, this is an unexpected pleasure.
Not for me. I've come to see what's left of our house.
It's still standing.
Only just. I see what you mean about bringing wealth to the area. A genuine old Chubb, circa 1977. Doubtless the work of the great Otto Chubb of Heidelberg, cabinet makers to the gnomes of Zurich.
It's just a safe. It's just a safe, that's all. You'll hardly notice it when it's finished.
Of course not, and it's so much more elegant than an antique Adam fireplace.
Oh, I wouldn't say that.
Then why did you throw it out?
Oh. I thought it was just an old fireplace.
Just an old fireplace? Do
Don't you realize you are throwing away the nation's heritage?
It didn't belong to the nation, it was mine.
Even so, it was a valuable piece. Anyway, it's a darn sight better than the one I got in my drawing room. I can't even get a horse on that.
Why are you keeping horses in your drawing room?
A picture of a horse. And me. And the Queen.
Here's a further episode from our serial on Out of the Glow.
Please, put your arms around me. Kiss me.
What?
Kiss me.
That's how it began. A foggy night, a lurking peril, and a lovely girl who was too young to die.
Like the phone, Eve. I don't seem to be able to find my key.
Oh, who cares? We're out. You've had a most enjoyable dinner.
Do you have your key?
Oh, what's the panic?
The phone, it might be... Ah, it stopped.
That's good. I don't want to talk to anyone but you.
Oh, well.
At least you found your keys. We don't have to spend the night in the corridor. I don't think the caretaker would like that. Even though we are married.
I suppose you didn't bring your key at all. You really could have been locked out if I'd done the same.
Well, it might have been fun at that. Oh, no.
I'll get it.
Look, for heaven's sake, you'd think it was someone calling to tell you you've won the Irish sweep.
Hello?
Mike, is that you?
What? Yes, but what's the matter? What are you calling here for?
I had to. Mike, could you come over right away? It's important.
I don't know.
I must see you tonight, Mike. You see, something's come up. Mike, it's a trap. Don't go. It's a trap.
Jan. Jan, are you there? Answer me.
You liar. You rotten cheat.
Eve, I haven't
time to... think that I believed you when you told me you wouldn't be looking for that girl anymore.
I wasn't lying. I'd already found her when I told you that.
And it is Jan Carter, isn't it? That's the girl the police...
Eve, she's in trouble. I've got to go. I'll explain later.
Mike, if you go out that door...
Sorry.
You needn't ever... come back. Oh, Mike, you stupid fool. Oh, the police... Hello, police. Look, this is very important, an emergency. I must get in touch with the Detective Inspector Charlton at once. What's that? Oh, what does it matter what my name and address is? I tell you, I must speak to Mr. Charlton right away.
Jan? Jan, it's Mike. Jan, you...
Come in, Chester.
Blaney.
Nice and quiet, please. We don't want to disturb the other lodgers. That's why I have a silencer on this gun, see?
Where's Jan Carter?
Right here. Come on in. Come on.
Jan! What have you done to her, Blaney?
Nothing. Just tied her up. And the gag was necessary. She tried to warn you on the phone, and I thought she might try it again when you arrived.
Let her go. If you've got some argument with me...
Oh, no. We've had all the arguments we're going to have, Chester. And we finish playing little games with each other.
You can't get away with this. You're in a house full of people. Mockridge must be downstairs.
Perhaps he is. But we've made sure we didn't disturb him. Haven't we, Jan? Oh, yes. We're as quiet as a couple of mice when we went out to ring you. Didn't use Mr. Mockridge's phone, of course. Didn't like to trouble him.
What are you after, Blaney?
As if you didn't know.
Take that gag off, Jan.
The gag? Well, perhaps I can, now that you're here. Couldn't take the risk after she tried to double-cross me with that phone call.
If you were trying to get me here, you should be satisfied I'm here.
So you are. I knew you'd come anyway. Perhaps all the faster when you thought your girlfriend was in trouble.
Oh, get that gag off!
Okay, then. But remember this. Either of you makes trouble, the other one gets a bullet. You understand that, Jan?
Yes, she understands.
Just bear in mind, Jan. You call out, I shoot your boyfriend. Right, huh? Off for the gag, then.
Jan, are you all right?
I'm all right. Oh, Mike, I'm sorry. I couldn't help it. He had a guy knocked on the door. I thought it was you.
It's okay.
Oh, it isn't okay. I should have been more careful. But I never thought he'd try anything like this. He'd been watching me for so long.
Yeah, I know. And what about that, Blaney? Why did you spend all that time just shadowing Jan and me, and then suddenly pull a fool stunt like this?
A man can run out of patience, you know. And I've been very patient. Up till now.
Patience? For what? What were you waiting for?
Perhaps for you to show me just where you hid it.
Hid? Hid what?
Now you listen to me, Chester. I told you we're finished playing games. You may have gathered I'm not too gentle with people who try to cross me.
Like Benny the Blink, for instance.
Eh?
Why didn't you kill him with your silenced pistol? Why did you bother to knife him?
Sure off your head, I didn't kill Benny while we were working for the same...
Same what? Same gang?
Never mind all that.
Slade's mob? You work for Slade, don't you?
Shut up!
Was it Slade's idea or your own to try the strong-arm Jan and me?
Chester, you're asking for it.
Your idea, huh? Decided to play the game your own way, did you?
I told you to shut up!
Mike!
It's okay, Jan. Take it easy.
You better both take it easy, see? And it's me who's asking the questions, Chester. Ah, I don't have a lot of time, and I mean to get some quick answers. So start talking. Where's that package?
Inspector, I've been trying to get hold of you.
So I heard, Mrs. Chester. I was out on a job tonight. They sent me word. I thought I might as well call in as phone.
Come in, please.
You seem upset. Something wrong?
I don't know.
Where's your husband?
He's out. He received a phone call and rushed out as though somebody had yelled fire.
Phone call?
From Jan Carter.
What?
I see you remember the name.
Extraordinary.
What's extraordinary about it? You knew he was after her, didn't you?
Yes,
probably
but...
half London knew he was after her. Everybody except me.
But you didn't know? But when I talked to you one day, I indicated that your husband...
You told me he might be getting involved in some tricky deal, and you asked me to try to persuade him to tell you about it when the time came.
I admit I was a bit vague. But surely you knew about Jan Carter.
I knew about her. That is, I knew she existed. I knew that Mike was looking for her at one time. He told me he wasn't looking for her anymore. I thought that was the end of it.
Instead, he'd already found her?
Yes. Well, they say wives are always the last to know, don't they?
Mrs. Chester, you say your husband got a phone call from Jan Carter.
I don't know what it was about, but before he rushed out, he did say she was in trouble of some kind.
Trouble?
And he had to go to her right away.
Did he say where?
Where?
Or did he say where he was going, where she rang from?
No.
And he didn't mention what kind of trouble the girl was in?
No, he didn't.
Then you don't know for sure that there is any trouble, do you?
Do you want an affidavit, Inspector? Why do you think I've been frantically trying to contact you?
Frankly, I have no idea.
What? Look, for all I know, my husband could have gone somewhere he might have been killed.
But if you don't know where that is, what do you expect the police to do about it?
Don't you know where this Jan Carter is?
No. We can find out, of course. We have ways of digging up people we want, but that takes time, perhaps days.
Oh, this is good enough for Gilbert and Sullivan.
Mrs. Chester, there are reasons, very good ones, why we have avoided pursuing Jan Carter too closely. There are also reasons why we've left your husband pretty much alone, despite the fact that we knew he was also after Jan Carter.
I don't think I have time right now for a lecture on modern police methods. I want you to find my husband before something happens to him.
I'd like that too, assuming something is going to happen to him, which might be assuming too much.
He said the girl is in trouble.
He might have been lying.
Why?
There are possibly 100 different reasons why a man might lie to his wife. It happens all the time.
Thank you. Now I'm not the least bit worried anymore.
Mrs. Chester, don't you really have any idea where he might have gone? Didn't he give you any hint at any time where the girl might be hiding out?
We never discussed her.
Well, pardon me. My impression was that she'd been discussed quite a lot. Look, did he ever mention a name, an address, anything?
Well, he spoke of that man, Blaney, the one
yes,
who...
yes, never mind Blaney. Anything else?
No, nothing. Oh, wait a minute. There was a man who rang here to
yes.
check on some person Mike was supposed to have recommended to him.
Recommended?
As a boarder or lodger or something. Now, what was the name? I know, Mockridge. That's it, I'm sure of it. Mockridge.
Mockridge.
I'm still waiting, Chester. And I'm finally beginning to run out of time and patience.
I don't even know what you're after, Blaney.
Well, she knows. And you're a boyfriend, so that means you know, too.
Do you know what he's talking about, Jen?
No, I have no idea.
Why, you lying little... Just for that, I ought to belt you one. You've been leading me on a string ever since you got off that ship you have.
Blaney, if you're after those contraband drugs, you may as
drugs?
Well...
Drugs? Who else said anything about drugs?
That was what was in that package Jan was tricked into carrying.
You're crazy.
Jan, you tell him. Tell him what you did with the stuff.
I threw it away.
You're lying. You wouldn't throw it away. Where is it?
Take your hands off her.
Now break her arm unless she tells me where she put
Why,
it.
Why, you...
You certainly know how to look for trouble, chum.
I will get rid of that gun. Out the window. Good. That makes us even, Blaney.
I'll murder you, Chester. You've crossed me for the last time.
Mike!
Told Jan earlier I was glad we seemed to be getting some action. But I meant action that would take her to a safe place overseas, not action like this. Despite my efforts, every day seemed to bring a new menace to this girl who was too young to die.
Mary Wilson wrote a poem describing Cambridgeshire. This is what it said. Huge echoing churches guarded by flinty walls and long straight Roman roads where dusty sunlight falls and cream brick houses patterned with flickering leaves where swallows build their clay nests beneath the eaves. At willows, weeping where the river dellies by, and floating far above me in the lark-hung sky, white clouds, which throw their sailing shadows as they pass on bloomy Cambridge meadows full of quaking grass. Through the Doors, an hour of picks from the Doors catalogue.
Paul Featherston introduces live and studio tracks, covers, interviews, commentary, documentary recordings and readings.
Plains FM, Saturdays at 7 p.m. Through the Doors, a must, an absolute must for any fan of music by that group. Dick Orkin, an American writer and producer of radio commercials, became even better known for comedy featurettes from the mid-1960s on, particularly for Chicken Man. A later creation of his was The Tooth Fairy.
Yeah? Hello there. I'm the Tooth Fairy, and I doth come from...
This is another secret adventure of the Tooth Fairy.
There must be easier jobs than being a tooth fairy. I mean, after a while, people stop listening when he tells them that mint fresh Ipana tastes totally tremendous and gets teeth clean and white. But what else can the Tooth Fairy do? He's a committed man. So the next time he tells you about the new mint fresh taste of Ipana, be courteous. Smile before you bite him with your Ipana strong white teeth.
The home of Harold and Thelma Wolf as embarking dog at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Your ferry ship, are you in there?
Yes, I am.
I am waiting in the bedroom closet of young Shirley Wolf, Mrs. Wolf's wild daughter.
When you tell my child that a handsome prince is going to come into her life and she should stop chasing boys like a wild person, it'll be like a miracle happened.
Mrs. Wolf?
Yes?
Why me?
But who else would have the prestige that she'd listen to?
I see.
Who else would have a magic wand that glows in the dark when he steps out of her closet?
Right.
Who else would...
I'm convinced, Mrs.
Wolf.
Yes. I just thought it was a job for Mr. Wolf, that's all, but I just remembered...
Are you kidding? He doesn't even know he has a daughter. He thinks it's a son named Arnold with long hair.
Long hair.
What?
I said Mr. Wolf thinks it's a son named Arnold with long hair.
That's right. He thinks it's a son named...
Mrs. Wolf.
What?
When will your daughter get home?
Well, she went to see a midnight horror movie at the Bijou.
She what?
The Attack of the Giant French Fried Shrimps, I think.
What?
Shrimps. Giant shrimps.
No, but I'll take turkey.
Well, that may be, but she loves that kind of movie.
Mrs. Wolf.
Yes?
One, why are we shouting through the closet door? And two, what are you talking about?
Oh, I can hear you much better this way.
When can I expect your daughter?
Very soon.
Mrs.
Wolf.
Please understand, it's not that I'm a terrific outgoing person that needs people all the time. On the other hand, solitary confinement is not my idea of a fun weekend either.
Would you like some bread and water?
Hmm?
I mean, would you like a sandwich and a drink?
Oh, yes, thank you.
How about a nice salad to start?
Yes, but hold the giant French fried shrimp.
Listen again tomorrow for another secret adventure of The Tooth Fairy.
The Tooth Fairy. Broadcast in the national interest by the makers of Mint Fresh Ipana. The new taste in your mouth.
That was The Tooth Fairy, and this is Concert in the Groove. Today, it's a Scandinavian husband and wife duo, Nina and Frederick, who, of course, were very popular here in the 1960s. From them, here is I Would Amour Her and Oh Cinnamon, especially for John Newman, well known to Burnside residents.
When shadows fall and stars appear, the sadness I feel I could not bear, and if I should relive that fateful day, I would not turn my love away. I reveal how I do adore her, hang my heart on my sleeve just for her, all my love throughout life assure her, if this moment I could amour her. When I think of her tender lips, gentle thoughts to her fingertips, reminisce on her eyes so fair, moonlight soft in her downy hair, I reveal how I do adore her, hang my heart on my sleeve just for her, all my love throughout life assure her, if this moment I could amour her. If someday I should see her smile, take her hand and may heart beguile, feel the warmth in her earnest prayer, darling, shield me from all despair. I reveal how I do adore her, hang my heart on my sleeve just for her, all my love throughout life assure her, if this moment I could amour her. Now I'm standing alone and sad, thinking of all the joys we've had. Time makes fools of man, they say, take me back to that distant day. Ooh, I reveal how I do adore her, hang my heart on my sleeve just for her, all my love throughout life assure her, if this moment I could amour her. I I sleep just for her. All my love throughout life assure her. If this moment I could amour her. Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Oh, cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Oh, cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Oh, on that day.
The Lord said, "Oh, Cinnamon, the moon will be bleeding. All on that day, will run to the Lord. Lord, won't you hide me? Run to the Lord. Lord, won't you hide me? Run to the Lord. Lord, won't you hide me? All on that day, will." The Lord said, "Oh, Cinnamon, you should have been a praying. The Lord said, "Oh, Cinnamon, you should have been a praying. The Lord said, "Oh, Cinnamon, you should have been a praying. All on that day, will
run to Satan, Satan, won't you hide me? Run to Satan, Satan, won't you hide me? Run to Satan, Satan, won't you hide me? All on that day."
Satan said, "Oh, Cinnamon, step right in." Satan said, "Oh, Cinnamon, step right in."
Satan said, "Oh, Cinnamon, step right in. All on that day, where?
Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? All on that day, where?
Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run to?
All on that
day." Oh, Cinnamon. And I Would Amour Her by today's artists in Concert in the Groove, Nina and Frederick. Finally, their own composition, Listen to the Ocean, for Krista Sparer, if you happen to be listening, in Marlow Road, Aranui.
And far from land, where evening breezes caress the shore like a gentle comforting hand. Fragrant blossoms, honeybees, careless laughter upon the breeze, and lovers fade into pools of deep purple shadows among the trees.
Listen to the ocean, echoes of a million seashells. Forever it's in motion, moving to a rhythmic and unwritten music that's played eternally.
Thank you. seagull's distant cry. His wings like parentheses drawn in the sky, and two white birds clinging like foam to the crest of a wave rolling by. The silence of noon, the clamor of night, the heat of a day when the fish won't bite. These are the things that remind me of the day you sailed out of sight. Listen to the ocean, echoes of a million seashells, forever it's in motion, moving to a rhythmic and unwritten music that's played eternally.
Nina and Frederick ending their appearance with Listen to the Ocean. And coming from the ocean, in fact, the Hauraki Gulf, between 1966 and 1970, of course, was a certain station on 1480 kilocycles.
It's the most talked about radio, 1480.
And indeed, Hauraki was at the time. On the programme in a week, our concert goer is back. Chris McCabe will introduce Pam Ayres. Also on then will be Selwyn Toogood and Shelley Berman, and a grand old Opry broadcast. In the meantime, Steve Price and myself, Paul Featherstone, hope that for you, life will be looking up. Goodbye. Out of the Glow is an Ear Media presentation recorded at WebMad Christchurch.